Hey, everybody, I'm Pat, grateful member of Al-Anon, and tonight's speaker really needs no introduction. He's been a friend of mine now for, I think it's 22 years, about 22 years or more that I've just got to watch him grow in his program and personal life and watch him accomplish so much. So we're all in for a real treat tonight. Let's welcome our speaker, Lee T.
All right. Good evening, everyone. My name's Lee.
Oh,
a pleasure to be here tonight. I want to thank Pat for asking me to share tonight. It's a very special honor to be doing this. I want to welcome our newcomers, Will, and online, Kurt E. My condolences, Kurt. Any other newcomers tonight? Hey, welcome. Glad to have you. One of the great things about meeting back in person is the opportunity to welcome newcomers. I'm glad we're together, even though we're seated in the manner that we are tonight. This group has the finest men that I have met in my entire life. And often, as we are holding hands and saying the closing prayer, I'm so grateful that this meeting will be here the next Thursday. And so we are always here. We've been here now for 32 years. And one of the great things about coming back is the memories of the guys who have been with us throughout the years, guys who have occupied seats in our group, but are no longer with us. Guys who have moved away. Guys who have meant so much to us and our recovery. And so God bless this meeting. May it be available for generations to come. So my story starts with my parents who were born in China, and they eventually made their way to the United States, to Knoxville, Tennessee, where I was born. I was their only child. And let me tell you, as an only child, I got a lot of attention. I was loved, and I felt loved. My parents worked hard, and they both had careers in the computer industry, and I did well. We moved to California, and I grew up with every advantage. Our family would, in many respects, would be an immigrant success story. But you know, it didn't all turn out that way because I'm in an Al-Anon meeting. And so it was my father who drank. And, some of my early memories are of him at parties and, drinking with his friends. But it was not only alcoholism that I experienced growing up. There was also domestic violence in the home. And in some respects, I'd say many respects, witnessing domestic violence as a child left more lasting impressions upon me than my father's actual drinking. I remember being shuttled into my room when I was young, before my parents would get into a fight, and hearing, not seeing what would happen, what was happening. Going downstairs the next morning and seeing dishes broken. I think from that experience, I grew very protective of my mother. And, you know, my mother's approval when I was young was the most important thing to me. I remember riding up in an elevator one day and just asking, you know, Mom, have I been a good boy today? And she was also, and remains, the sunshine of my life. You know, I always wanted my mother to pick me up from school because she drove the nice car. She was well-dressed. And you know, she knew, and my parents knew, how to have fun. When I grew up, my parents had had high expectations for me. And Pat and I were just talking before the meeting about this page in the Courage to Change. If only blank would happen, I would be happy. And that was my thinking growing up. If only I got good grades, I'd get into a good college. And if I got into a good college, get a good job, if I got a good job, I'd be happy. And as I realized later, growing up with that type of thinking never made it necessary for me to talk about my father's drinking. And as we know, alcoholism is a progressive disease. And as I entered my teenage years, our family began to deteriorate. My father lost his job. My mother had back problems, and she went on disability. And as I got a little older, I dropped out of school. The first signs that something was wrong is that I started to experience tension headaches. And I believe today that alcoholism has many effects on our lives, and some of them are physical. And so I would be in, I'd be studying, and then I'd have to stop because I couldn't concentrate on what I was doing. I lost my ability to focus and to concentrate. I would spend I'd spend time in my room crying. Just I didn't know why. My mother, or my parents, thought that it was because I got into a I fell off my bike one time, and so they sent me to get MRIs. And various tests. And I remember sitting in the neurologist's office one time, and he told my parents and me that there was nothing physically wrong with me. And then the next words out of his mouth were, here are referrals to some counselors. And so I started seeing a therapist. And that was the first time I can remember actually talking to someone about what was going on. Now, I don't remember talking about my father's alcoholism or drinking, but I remember feeling guilty about talking about the family secrets. And I hadn't come to Al-Anon yet. But you know, I, for that period of time, when I was out of school, I remember, you know, not a lot of my friends dropped out. So I felt ashamed, confused. I felt depressed. And, you know, I found a room in, we were living up at the Bay Area at the time. I found a room in San Francisco. I remember just walking around the city. And for those of you who who've been around San Francisco, wonderful town to walk around in. But I remember walking around the city, some of those nice Victorian homes, looking in those windows and thinking to myself, you know, what do they have that I don't? I just remember feeling in so much emotional pain. I would walk around the city just seeing red. Eventually, I remember having conversations with my mother as well. About my father's drinking. And, you know, she said, and I remember my mother's response, "Don't worry about Dad. You know, just try your best, you know, try your best try your best in school." And I never thought that my father's drinking affected me the way that it has. Eventually, I did get, I studied abroad for a year, and I did return to school. But when I returned to school, I knew and I realized that I had to have some more balance in my life, because I could have studied 24 hours a day. Shortly after returning to school, I remember a friend of mine was visiting our house, and he saw a bunch of beer bottles that were in the trash. And he said, "You know, Lee, who's drinking all this?" And I said, "It was my dad." And he said, "You know, you got to do something about this." That's what he said. And I remember going out to dinner with my father and his friend, and he proceeded to, he drank a bottle of wine and some more. And I remember going to bed that night, just feeling like, you know, I don't know, just feeling like there was nothing more I can do about my father's drinking, because I was obsessed with my father's drinking. He would wake up in the middle of the night to pour himself a drink. And as soon as he turned on the hallway light, I would wake up. Now, he didn't make a big ruckus, but I remember sitting in bed, hearing him go down the stairs, open the freezer, get some ice, put it in his cup. And I didn't realize it then, but I was focused on his drinking. And that night, after we had gone out to dinner, I realized, you know, there's nothing more I can do. And somehow I found my way to an AA Central office. And I got some literature for him. I went to a nearby hospital, to their treatment center, and I got some literature from there. And I remember going back home and, you know, saying, "Dad, I'm concerned about your drinking." It didn't take on. AA didn't take hold then, but I had along the way heard about Al-Anon. And my first meeting was near the school that I was attending. And it was on a Monday night. And my first impression of that meeting was, wow, these people share a lot of embarrassing details about their life. And I remember someone calling me a few nights afterwards, welcoming me to Al-Anon. And at my first meeting, I got this, which is our original AA 12 and 12. And so When I returned back to school, I met my wife, who's now my wife, and we had met in the dormitory cafeteria, and we have been married now, almost 23 years.
Thank you.
She has given me two boys who are the pride and joy of my life. I had to, we were just discussing this just yesterday morning, how different our personalities are. She says what's on her mind. And I tend to play it fairly close to the chest. And as my sponsor knows, she is a very cause-oriented person. And so she has very strong beliefs. And some of her strong beliefs have to do with men. And I remember one time, I was living up in the Bay Area, she was living down here. She said, all men are pigs. And the next thing I know, later that evening, I'm driving down to Los Angeles, and I show up at her doorstep the next morning because I wanted to make things right. But this program has been instrumental, and that's an understatement, in my marriage. But going back to when I was new in the program, I moved down here about a year after I started Al-Anon, and I came, and the first time I came to this meeting, this man, this African American man, approaches me, and he pats me on the butt, and he says, "Are you new?" And like I say, my sponsor loves me in a very special way. And I remember those early meetings. I've talked with several of you tonight about it. We used to meet in a much smaller room. But I remember sitting in those meetings, and Jack was there, and of course my sponsor Willie. I remember sitting in those meetings, looking at the floor and feeling as worthless as a piece of gum stuck on the floor. And my self-esteem had sunk so, so low. And I'm reminded, when I think back on those times, I'm reminded of a page in our One Day at a Time. Wonderful thing about Al-Anon is that we are encouraged to renew our faith in a power greater than ourselves. We may have thought we were beaten, but we had merely forgotten that God has given us the strength and the means to hold up our heads and live. We learn once again to identify ourselves with the divine principle that rules us all. And so I didn't realize then, but when I was new in the meeting and felt despair, felt beaten, that God was with us, that God was taking care of us, and that he would show me the way. I would continue to work the steps, and I practiced, the most helpful way to, for me, of practicing step four was through the big book, the column method, which is essentially, you write down who you're resentful towards, okay, why you're resentful towards the person, what it affects, my security, self-esteem, personal, professional relations, what have you, and what my part in the resentment is. And I don't quite know how it works, but it does. Because when I identify what my part in a resentment is, and I always have a part in a resentment, then as if by magic, the resentment goes away. And so I can't tell you how many times I have written down, you know, I want to be right, even if it means nurturing grievances, seeing myself as a victim, or wallowing in self-pity. I take offense at people's words and I take them personally. I blame others when I fall short of my own expectations. And I can say to you today that by and large, I live free of resentments. And it's because of these steps. Another page in our One Day at a Time that was so meaningful to me is page 120. And you look at the back of the One Day at a Time, and there's an index of topics. And there is one page for the topic forgiveness. And this is it, or this is part of it. A little meditation on the word forgive can shed some rather surprising light on our understanding of the word. We are asked to forgive those who have injured us. Unless we have first judged and condemned them for what they did, there would be no reason for us to forgive them. Rather, we would have to forgive ourselves for judging. And so that reminds me that when I have a resentment, I have a part. And sometimes that part is because I'm judging and condemning that other person for what they did. My father would eventually find Alcoholics Anonymous. After that first conversation, we had another, and we talked about his drinking. He said, you know, Lee, have I ever abused you? Have I ever hit you when I was drinking? And I had to say no. But by that time, I had found Al-Anon. And I know that, and I knew that I belonged here. And so this discussion that we were having about whether or not he was an alcoholic really was not, it wasn't important. But what was important was that at the end of that discussion, he said, Lee, take me to a meeting. And he went out, he drove somewhere. And I just remember, I remember standing in the hallway of our home, tears streaming down my face, because I had begun to realize what Al-Anon had done for me. And I knew and hoped that Alcoholics Anonymous could do the same for my father. And we say, we read in the literature that joy and pain are like, you know, they're intertwined, they're mixed. And I remember as tears were rolling down my face, feeling joy and feeling the pain of having lived with this family disease. And so he came back, and we went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I enjoyed it, and I think he slept through most of it. But that started his journey, and I was so proud of my father. I think he probably was in his early 50s when he started Alcoholics Anonymous, and he got a sponsor. He started working the steps. We went to meetings together. And one Christmas, my sponsor may remember, I called him and I said, because I was living in LA at the time. And I called him, I said, you know, I'm nervous about going back to see my father. And Willie said to me, you know, be of service. And at that time, my father and my mother were separated, but they were living in the same house. I went up there, and we rode the bus around San Francisco. I still have a receipt from one of the restaurants that we went to. And it was memorable. I would go up again in February, and I knew something was wrong because I saw beer around the house. Shortly after our return from that trip, I got a call from my mother saying that she had found my father dead on the floor. And that was the first time that I experienced grief. And I remember that night, my sponsor came down to where I was living. My wife came over. I remember the guys at this meeting passed around a card, signed it, and I kept it next to my bed. And I realized that the only way to get through grief or to go through grief, to get on the other side, is to go through it, to feel our feelings. And my feelings would come up at random times. When I was driving, when my mind was turned off, the tears would come. And I felt all different types of things. I felt relief that my mother she no longer had them to decide whether or not to divorce my father. I felt guilt because I couldn't save my father. I felt resentment, the resentments that I still had towards my father. And I found lasting relief by turning once again to our literature, and specifically to our 12 and 12, step one. The feelings of release, of yielding or letting go, when we acknowledged that no change in others can be forced, help to loosen the suffocating grip of our destructive emotions, guilt, fear, self-pity, resentment. We found, to our surprise, a new feeling of relaxation, as though a weight of care had been lifted from us. In Al-Anon, we express our emotional detachment from our problems in such sayings as live and let live, and let go and let God. Because you see, I would think back to the day that he died, and I would think, you know, if I had just called him, maybe he wouldn't have taken his last drink. So when I got to step 9, I wrote a letter to my father, as I heard it suggested in this meeting. And at one of our retreats, I read it to the guys here. And then I read it at his gravesite. And since that day, I have had peace of mind with respect to my father. And there is nothing other than this program and all of you who made that possible. A couple years ago, I should say, maybe it's getting a little longer now, I remember my mother visiting from San Francisco. And out of the blue, she talked about some of the abuse that she suffered. From my father. And for weeks afterwards, I felt the resentment again. And then I realized I don't want to live that way anymore. And so again, I'm reminded of forgiveness and page 120 of our One Day at a Time. My mother would and continues to live in the home that I grew up in. And for many years now, she's lived with a partner. He's been a great companion to my mother. And I've been very grateful to him for his companionship, for all of that he's done for my mother. But it's been a challenge. In 2015, my mother was diagnosed with dementia. And I didn't really notice much of a change right away. But over the years, since then, her memory has declined. First, she lost her license. Her doctor revoked her license. And she was so mad. In 2019, in October, I visited and I noticed that the condition of the home was unkempt. And I think a part of me realized that she was having difficulty, that they were having difficulty taking care of themselves. And I remember coming back from that trip, it was October 15th. That night, I couldn't sleep. And for the next 2 years, I experienced insomnia. I didn't know why at first. It was just like the tension headaches. I didn't know why. And I wrote about it and wrote about it, thought about it, and I couldn't sleep. Meanwhile, my mother's memory, her cognitive abilities continued to decline. And I got angry. I said to them, you know, you guys can't go on like this. My mother wasn't bathing. You know, it was during the pandemic too, which very hard on seniors. I said, you guys have to come up with a plan, you know, or move down to Los Angeles and we'll care for you. But they didn't. We tried sending caretakers into the home, and they would turn them away. And I told them, you know, come up with a plan. Otherwise, I'm going to come up with a plan for you. And I was so torn, because in our program, we have slogans like live and let live, let go and let God, mind your own business. And I thought, you know, who am I to tell them what to do? And meanwhile, I couldn't sleep. I was anxious about it. And I was going back and forth about what my options were. And I remember the phone call to my sponsor. I remember exactly where I was. And I realized then that I could no longer stand by and do nothing as my mother continued to deteriorate. So, without getting into the details, I took my mother to court. I took her companion to court. My mother would say to me on the phone, "Why are you doing this? Don't ever talk to me again." So this is the woman whose approval I sought my entire life. But I know that she would never allow herself to live in the condition that she was living. This is the woman who always dressed well, who I was so proud to pick me up from school. Thank you. And so today I can say that she has excellent care. She puts up a fight with her caregivers, and they are very creative about getting her to brush her teeth, to shower, but she has the best care available. I can say that I sleep a lot better. And I've learned that sometimes love means to let someone else be exactly who they are. Sometimes love means take action. And today, I can say that the last couple of years, in the last couple of years, I've learned what it means to take responsibility as my mother's son. I didn't want that responsibility. I was fine with my own life here in Los Angeles. But it's made me a better person. My parents gave me every advantage in life. They gave me every opportunity. My wife and I have shared many good years. Like I said, she's given me two boys who are my pride and joy. But it is my higher power. It is this program. And most importantly, it is you who have taught me how to live. It is you, week after week, share your secrets meeting after meeting with me is you who listen to me share mine. It's you who holds my hand at the end of the meeting. I'm in need of comfort, reassurance. You come to my side after my father passed, helped me grieve, signed a card, kept next to my bed. You. Save me from despair. My sponsor has spent countless hours on the phone with me. Call him from everywhere. I remember one time I was calling him from a payphone at school and a tree fell on me. I heard a speaker say one time, an A speaker, she calls her sponsor every day. And I tried that with my sponsor. He shows up for people. And those of you who are privileged to call him sponsor know that. I'm grateful for his former spouse, Melody, for welcoming me into their family when I was new into the program. Grateful to his current spouse, Patty, for welcoming me into her life. Pat asked me to speak. Of course, I said, thank you. But down inside, I was terrified. I never want to go through the pain that I experienced before this program. And even reliving the pain is something that I don't necessarily look forward to. But I'll tell you this. I would do it all over again. Without hesitation, if I knew that I would find you again in these rooms, for the newcomer, Will and Kurt, welcome to Elena. I hope you keep coming back. I hope you find a measure of comfort and a measure of joy that we have found in these rooms as well. God bless this program. May it be available to for generations to come. God bless you. Thank you for letting me share.